It is Saturday, August 23rd, 2014. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the minis and the twits.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or the Geeks affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the studio with me right now is Phoenix Taves. He's a digital artist and software engineer. Hi, Phoenix.
Hi, Lyle. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. I invited you to come on. Because I want to talk about Burning Man, which we'll do a little bit later in the show. And I've never been. I wanted somebody in the air room with me that's been. When people suggested you, friends of friends suggested you on Facebook, which is really funny because you and I know each other very well. Uh-huh. And so then I thought, oh, yeah, Phoenix on again. And then I realized that I've never had you on the program, which is amazing to me.
No, you've actually invited me on several times.
Oh, okay.
It's just never actually happened.
Ah, good, good. Okay, well, that's good. At least I haven't been ignoring you completely. So, Phoenix, you're a software engineer. You do iOS development. You do lots of other types of development. But in the last few years, you've been doing virtual reality on iOS development. Devices, right?
Augmented reality.
Yes. Sorry. Well, why don't you clarify what augmented versus virtual is?
Oh, well, that's sort of a...
It's a fuzzy line, I know.
It's a fuzzy line, yeah. Augmented reality is sort of taking virtual reality and inverting it. So in a concept of a virtual reality, you're usually in a sedentary space or an inside space and going into a virtual world, immersed in a virtual world.
Right.
In augmented reality, you take that virtual world, apply it to something that can be moved around in physical space, outside usually, or maybe in a gallery or something like that. Very commonly nowadays, we're using iPhones or Android phones, cell phones.
Mm-hmm. Just because they've got the display capabilities.
They've got the display capabilities. They've got GPS, which is used for identifying your position in space. They've mm-hmm. got cameras, which also helps identify your position in space as well as...
So when you got your Master's of Digital Arts from New Media from UCSC, your graduate thesis piece was about a system that allowed you to have a narrative that you walked with, or an engine that allowed you to overlay context on top of the world around you. And the way that worked was holding an iPad, basically. The camera's just, videotaping the world, and then you're overlaying content that's mapped to that physical space, that virtual image. So it feels like it's with you in the real world. It's augmenting the current world.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. So I wrote that. I wrote that system from scratch in Danem, which was
very cool.
Quite a task.
And Phoenix and I know each other, of course, from UCSC. I was in the Digital Arts New Media program as a technical person for a long time, and Phoenix came through a few times and got his degree and shaped the program in a lot of ways. In any case, let's move on to the news at hand. Miles will be joining us shortly, I hear. But let's go ahead and talk a little bit about this wonderful. I heard the story a few weeks ago. We might have covered on Geeks because I haven't completely listened to all the recent episodes. But the basic idea was, what happens when a monkey grabs a camera and takes a photograph? And when I say a monkey, some kind of animal, really, takes a photograph. Who owns the copyright of that image? Because traditionally in the U.S., as soon as creative work is created, it's owned by the person that created it. And if it's a collaborative work, it's owned by those people. And of course, you can delegate those rules and such by contract. So if I work at Netflix, so if I make something at Netflix, actually, I've already signed a contract that says everything I do in my job is owned by the corporation, not by me. And that's one of the trade-offs I get for being paid. So in the world where anything you create gets owned by the creator by default, when a monkey takes a photograph, who owns the image? And the story really was that hit the news everywhere was, nobody does. It's public domain. There isn't an owner.
Well, it hit the news because of Wikipedia. So Wikipedia had the same picture, a picture of a monkey that was...
A self-portrait. A selfie.
A self-portrait, yeah. So it was basically a guy was out, I forget his name, but a photographer was out photographing nature, and a monkey picked up his camera and started taking selfies. And one of those selfies is actually rather stunning. It's a selfie. It almost seems like the monkey knew what it was doing. Maybe it did. had a big smile on his face. You know?
Yeah. What's interesting is our culture right now is inundated with selfies, right? The idea of a picture that taken by yourself is such a common thing now that we have it's the image type has entered the zeitgeist of what an image is. So we see a lot of them. We have a lot more feelings and general knowledge of that type of image, right, in the world right now than we used to.
Yeah.
So now it's kind of we can judge them well. And this happens to be an excellent one.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, on that level too, like I just read something where one-tenth of all the photos ever taken in the entire history of photography were taken in the last year.
Oh, so depressing. and 94% of them are selfies.
So this became a question with Wikipedia because they put that picture up as a public domain image, and the photographer contested that, said that he owned the image, and the copyright office just last week jumped in and said that you cannot copyright or register works by animals, plants, or supernatural beings. That's the heading for the from what have you finding on the internet. But
okay, so that's cool. I mean, it makes a little bit of sense. And therefore, since you're not copywriting it, it's technically public domain. As is, I think, images captured by state employees and things of that nature as well on the job. So what's the side effect of this in the digital arts context where new forms of creativity are emerging all the time?
Right. Well, so this becomes a very, very complicated thing because, what you know, they're talking about, they give a list of things that they give a list of examples, but those list of examples can just as easily apply to an automated system. So they talk about things like a mural painted by an elephant or driftwood that has been shaped by the ocean. Well, that's an interesting one right there because if you go back to, say, someone like Marcel Duchamp, who brings in these ready-made things made by somebody else and calls them his own work, is that copyrightable? And I don't know what the answer is to that. But when it comes to digital arts, we can create systems whereby I could create a system where a photograph gets taken of somebody or scene or something like that without me being involved with the process at all.
Right. Well, except you wrote the software to do that originally.
Yes, I wrote the software, but then...
So the software itself was copyrighted because you wrote it.
Is that the device? Yeah, the software's copyrighted. So in the case of the camera, for instance, with the monkey, does Canon own the picture of the monkey because Canon made the camera?
Right.
Right, but that's the device.
So I heard... we've had a couple copyright shows on. I've got a friend who I invite on. He's a copyright lawyer to some degree, digital rights lawyer. And one of the things that I was shocked by was this idea that if when you send your kids off to school, elementary school, and they get pictures taken, the company that took those photographs keeps the copyright, and they sell rights to individual copies for the photo. So if you then scan that copy and then redistribute it, actually that's not part of the contract that you have, right? They own that photo. But if you tell your child before you leave, when they say, pose, I want you to do this, you have now directed that scene and you are a copyright holder of any content because the photo is then a derivative of your directed work, right? So this weird thing can happen if you are part of the creative process, right? So a director of a play has responsibility. A director of a film has responsibility, even though the actor is the one being captured and the cinematographer is the one using the camera. There can be other artists involved. So in this case of a digital art, wouldn't that kind of apply in the sense that if you wrote the software, you had an intention of this kind of thing happening, it's part of your creative process for it to happen.
Well, there's some more questions that go farther down the road on that, and we're getting into a world where we have AIs, for instance, that mm-hmm. that create things that are beyond
artificial intelligences. They're not super strong right now, but they exist. Yeah,
right,
they drive cars.
Well,
for example,
you know, even up at UC Santa Cruz here in the ICE lab, they've developed systems where they make games where the game content, the output of the game, is unpredictable in terms of the original designers don't know what it's going to create.
And therefore, if you play the game and it creates something, is that output yours?
Is that output
yours? Is that
yours,
copyrighted nobody?
Is it copyrighted nobody, or is it the original designer's copyright? Yeah. Who owns that? There's been other questions that I've heard about crowdsourced works, works that are come from all over the internet. And if you don't have the proper rights installed in the first place where you say, oh, we own everything that you create, who owns any of that? Is it owned by everybody? Is it owned by the person who puts together the crowdsourced work in the end work, if you will, from the crowdsource? Or is it some sort of nebulous public domain thing at that point? So there's a lot of questions, at least from the side of myself as an artist. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a copyright lawyer, but I do investigate this stuff because I want to be able to sell my work, and my work is often somewhat ephemeral in terms of the way copyright
works. What I love about what the Copyright Office did, though, is they did make the right step, right? I mean, I think that saying, look, you can't just have a piece of equipment, and if you have a piece of equipment, like let's say they said, oh, actually, Canon made the camera, and therefore, since a monkey took a picture of that camera, then Canon's the copyright holder. Like, that would be really bad
in some sense, exactly.
Right?
And that's, that closes that question.
Right.
For sure.
And then the next question would be, let's talk about some digital artworks that are triggered by the participant, right? So let's imagine that you've got a piece that's going to be a time lapse of a public street, right? And the way that it gets triggered, the photo gets triggered, it doesn't get triggered by a time based, but it gets triggered anytime someone is jumping in the scene, right? So if there's ever a detection of a human being jumping, it takes a snapshot. And right. Then over a year, you get, I don't know, 1,000 pictures if it's a really crowded scene, and it's kind of interesting title. Whose is that, right? I mean, you wrote the algorithm you found somebody else's algorithm really to find out if jumping occurred, and then you produced the art, then you installed it, you got some permissions probably from somebody that has access to that space. But then the actual jumper is the one that said this photo is going to happen now. But they did it totally unintentionally, right? They have no conscious knowledge that it's happening.
Right.
So this is the kind of space that's really intriguing, I think, for geeks to kind of investigate.
Yeah, well, there was a piece a while back, and I'm probably going to misrepresent it.
We do that all the time here.
What I remember of it was the essence of it was an art piece. It was images and data and text and things like that were being crowdsourced and then placed into this giant image of a fingerprint. And the artists themselves had never thought about the copyright issues at the time. Later on, they wanted to make derivative works from that, so they wanted to make prints of all this data. And when they went to do that, they realized they had this huge problem of copyright because they didn't know that they need to get permission from all the thousands of people who invested in the project or not.
Could
they just use it?
Right.
And because they wanted to sell the works. I never heard the resolution.
It's the selling
part
that's tricky.
It's the selling part.
If you don't want to sell it, whatever.
Right.
But if you're making money off of it, you better figure out the copyright rules. Yeah. Interesting. Well, Miles Elam just joined us. Thank you, Phoenix, for that story about copyright and potential effects of copyright on digital artists. Or digital art, I should say. Not really the artists. It's really about...
the digital artist.
Anyway,
yeah.
Thank you so much. Miles, can you tell us about some hacking that's happened recently, please?
Yes. It turns out that when folks from the University of Michigan were testing out the city's streetlights, they found that they were not only connected to the internet, but did not have that much security on them.
No.
So anyone who has a laptop and the right kind of radio could...
just pick them up.
Yeah,
within
range. But the thing is, they aren't hardlined like some they are in some other places. In other words, there's no wire that connects all of them. They have wireless receiver boxes that take information from other spots and relay that information.
Yeah, kind of a mesh network kind of thing.
Yes, mm-hmm. And the radio, sends signals just like Wi-Fi sends signals.
Sure.
It's not the same frequency as Wi-Fi, probably for very good reasons. But if you can get on that frequency and then send packets over it, turns out there's no security on that. There's nothing like the equivalent of HTTPS or just an encrypted channel, no VPN, no...
So what you're saying is if you've got the antenna, which now, of course, you can buy for $14 or something somewhere, you can just look at any of them.
Yes. And that covers almost 100 intersections in the unnamed Michigan city that they were testing this in. And that's they control that from a single point.
Oh, so you go to one point that's in the mesh at any point, and
yep.
Then you can access all the feeds.
Yep.
Wow.
The disruption in digital arts potential of that is
I tremendous. Know. Who would own the copyright on those babies? So what's interesting about that, of course, is you could kind of assume that that's public knowledge, right? Because the camera itself is in public view, and it's recording the public streets, right? So theoretically... You could be standing there with an iPhone on that corner too and doing it. But it's the mass install that's so useful. Because using that with some OCR, you could track cars in that city.
By the way, this is not the best part.
Oh, no. what city is it? They didn't say. Okay.
For security reasons.
Yeah, right.
Security through obscurity.
What I love, though, of course, is that that's the, you know, that camera model, that's everywhere probably. Right. They just tested one city. It could be anywhere. It could be here.
the thing is that when they ask the city about it, saying like, hey, we found this, what's going on with that? The city has then said, or the contractor that worked with them was basically telling them, that wasn't part of the contract to have it be secure.
Yeah, right.
And the thing is, yeah, and so, well, not so much that. It's just when the city puts out a contract going for the lowest bidder, saying, who's going to do this
piece
of infrastructure for us? The security is going to be another piece that you have to test, and it's going to add to the price.
Yeah, it's really expensive.
So if you don't specify that there needs to be security, the company that goes, wait, there needs to be security on that, is going to have a bid that costs more than the lowest bidder.
Yeah.
That just goes like, hey, whatever. We can do that.
I can buy these cameras anywhere. They're cheap.
Or so, radios, yeah.
Yeah, radios. Yeah. Oh, really cool. Well, thanks for that wonderful story. I want to know where it is, but actually more than that, how much is the gear necessary to snoop in these things?
Oh, a radio? Come on.
Yeah, cheap,
like,
right?
I'm sure like you could get it at a ham surplus. Like,
oh, man. Find,
yeah.
Now I want to start hacking my neighborhood.
I'm just imagining all these people wandering around war driving the neighborhoods trying to find out which city this is.
Which city it is. Yeah, well, I'm sure that the researchers that did this didn't publish it out of politeness. But now that it's available, the world will figure it out pretty quickly.
And hopefully cities will learn to add security into their request for bids.
That would be a good
By
future,
the way, random case. People with laptops and radios can't just run around and get access to it. You know, bullet point.
All right, let's move on a bit. I'm going to jump down to you, Phoenix, on more digital art. And let's talk about an example of a piece that's questionable in the copyright space, this composited image art piece.
I don't know that it's actually an art piece. I think it's actually some researchers.
Oh, okay, sorry.
I think they're thinking of some of the commercial potential for it, but it certainly has art potential as well. It's a system that called Average Explorer, they have a paper. I think it was subtitled "Interactive Exploration and Alignment of Visual Data Collections," which is kind of a mouthful. But it's some UC Berkeley computer scientists led by Alexei Efros. They created a tool for analyzing images constructed from thousands of other images online. So
okay.
they would grab 10,000 images or more off of the internet, stack them up into this.
And these are images of the same top subject?
Most of them are, although they showed some examples where they weren't always.
Okay.
But, you know, where you can pick out certain details of things.
Okay.
And the system allows you to pick features out of the
conglomerate.
Sets, the conglomerate.
Okay. So an example that you showed me, which we'll link up to the GeekSpeak website, is like the Colbert Report stream, where he's got a picture next to him, he moves around, and over a period of time, there's thousands of images. They're video, but they're images. And you could actually select, like, his eye or something.
Yeah, you could select his eye, or you could select, for instance, the image that was sitting next to him and start seeing all the images of Obama or something like that, you know, or all the images of a particular person he talks about a lot.
Okay.
Another good example that they used as sort of a conceptual example, they showed some pictures of cats, like all these pictures, images of cats, and they wanted to see tabby cats with pointy ears and green eyes. So they were able to, you know, draw out where the eyes are, where the ears are, and have the images start picking up what the
base one was.
The base.
Some similar.
Similar. Or blue, you know, blue butterflies was another example they gave. But this has interesting potential for, as artists, you know, you can do interesting things with these averaged images.
Well, the other thing is that the image in general stays averaged.
Correct.
And then you can pull out details where you want the line specific. So you're producing a new piece, a new image from thousands of images.
Correct.
It's interesting. Well,
and then some big questions, you know, where does your data set come from? I mean, if you're pulling, say, from Flickr, only from Flickr, you know, you can pick only public domain images. But
right.
If you're picking out some of those images or copyrighted images, do you have to get permission from everybody to actually produce a derivative work off of that? Or is this actually a new work?
Right.
There are artists who go both ways on that. I've known artists who do average work with averages like this, who go ahead and just use it, and they just say it's mine, and they leave it at that. You know,
right,
and
right.
Well, if somebody sues me, that's great. Whatever, we'll deal with it then. And then there are others who try to be diligent and go and get permission from everybody. But that can be hard when you have 10,000 100,000. I mean,
yeah, that can be really hard.
The article says that there are in the world approximately 10 trillion images. So
yeah, that's a lot.
If you're going to work with that whole data set, I doubt you're ever going to do that. But if you did,
well, also if you're working with that data set as your base, and even if you only use, let's say, 100 images, the finding those images had to do with the data set, right? So the data set has some value in there as well. All the images have some value to some degree with
Correct.
The original piece.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. it's a big data question. Is they're calling this another one of those big data questions? The images themselves have been an untapped resource for actually mining interesting things,
right? And composite interesting things.
In composite, yeah. And certainly the people who are building this, we're talking about the income potential of the data that they can collect from this.
So I thank you very much, Phoenix, for that. Sorry, I realize now in that I totally misrepresented your story. We're not talking about camera feeds of traffic lights that you were covering, Miles. We're talking about traffic light information.
We're talking about controlling the traffic lights. Yeah.
Controlling traffic lights. So in that city, you step into this and you can completely control the traffic light.
Yes.
From anywhere.
Yes.
If you have this antenna.
Yes.
That's much worse. Why didn't you stop me on my stupidity? You're like, it's such a hard story to do that. If I stopped you all the time. So that's horrible. Are they shutting it down? I mean, that's deadly.
It's their setup. Like, how do you shut down every street light in a 100 intersection radius?
Oh, you cause them to start blinking red, and then you let humans do the decision-making factors.
But how do you control them to do blinking red?
You just
set up on the radio, except that the radios are hackable. So
it's not a good story. All right, thank you. That's really kind of scary. Now, that's not interesting in a neat ooh-wow thing at all now. That's scary.
I'm sorry, I hadn't intended it to be an ooh-wow thing.
Yeah, well, I made it into that. I wanted it to be ooh-wow instead. Can't it just be cameras? Ah, scary. All right, tell us what Congress is doing lately.
Well, Congress has had a long storied history of going on to various sites, including Wikipedia, and editing them for partisan purposes. When you can't get reality to back
to jive
your argument,
with your story.
you just kind of make your story make reality bend to your will. There's actually a Twitter feed that when it was announced, I thought, like, wow, this is really interesting. It's called Congress Edits. So at Congress Edits on Twitter, and or Congress-Edits.
Okay.
And what it does, it's a bot, just like we were talking about last week, where the huge number of...
Great show, by the way, last week. I listened to that.
Number of Twitter accounts are not people, but they're manned by computer programs.
That's right.
Or computer algorithms. And what this does is checks to see, okay, here's the IP range of the Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives. And if there's ever an edit from those IPs to Wikipedia by a non-authenticated account.
Got it. So you can, of course, create an account and then authenticate who you are. So potentially a journalist could be in that IP range for some reason. They're there, but they've already registered themselves and stuff.
And this is very useful for example, if you're talking about a biological topic, losing my words here, that if you have someone authenticated saying, yes, I have a degree in biochemistry from so-and-so university, and
it's a lot easier to go, okay, that's probably an appropriate edit.
Yes.
Yeah. But political edits, or, you know, about politics and stuff, can be sensitive.
Right, they tend to have a lot more churn than the scientific ones as well.
Right. So you can also have just a generic account. You don't have to have an identified account. You could create a fake account, whatever, and then you can edit stuff.
Right. You can just go anonymously and say... Here's a change.
So they looked at all.
And that's how a huge number of edits on Wikipedia happened. So it's not necessarily a bug. That's actually a feature
to
get the information in there.
I agree. So what you're saying is they looked at all these anonymous accounts or accounts that weren't verified. So it could be anybody from the range of Congress, the location Congress. And then this Twitter feed kind of shows what Congress is writing.
Right.
The staff, really.
Right. Yeah. And it's really from about three IPs that they're seeing a lot of these changes.
What kind of topics do they seem to be interested in modifying?
So recently, I mean, in the past, there have been so many changes that have been for obvious partisan purposes that don't reflect reality that they actually banned the congressional IPs for a period of a period of time.
And sometimes they'll ban the modification of certain hot topics, right? So that,
but in this case, it was a blanket ban just on those IPs, saying like, "Hey, Congress, you're cut off until you know sober up." And
wouldn't they just travel and just go somewhere else and write it? I mean,
you would think, but
okay, go on.
And I'm sure there are a fair amount of edits being done by, you know, lobbyists in an adjacent building, but nevertheless. So this is what's going on there. But recently they took away the ban. And once again, this is only for anonymous accounts. If you have an authenticated account, it doesn't block you. That a staffer decided that they were going to edit transgender issues. And, for example, call transphobic to be, instead of being a fear of someone changing their gender to fit their internal
gender
view of themselves. And I'm using the wrong terminology for that, but I'm sorry. And to change that to be, for example, if you believe that men should be men and women should be women.
Oh, they changed that language instead.
To be something along those lines, to say that we're completely justified in being
this way.
And it's not a bad thing.
That was modified by someone.
A congressional staffer.
Mm-hmm.
There was a specific edit to the Orange is the New Black and the, I'm forgetting her name right now. But
Laverne Cox.
Laverne Cox. And it had edited from, edited to say,
transgender.
No, it's transgender to a woman who used to be a real man, or something like that.
Gross. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nasty.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not doing verbatim right now.
Sure.
So I go through, but it was a long series of things, and they had a long discussion about it after the fact.
Right. One of the things you can do on any Wikipedia edits is actually have a discussion about the page and the edits, and it's a forum basically on every single page.
Sometimes you get into edit wars,
yes.
But especially when you realize that someone else has a lot more power than you. In other words, the mods on a
right
on an article. You go to the discussion and go like, "Hey, what is this? This is just, you know, a point of view." And the mod wasn't having anything of it. The admin was just saying, "This is not a point of view. This is hate speech, and
right.
we have no room for hate speech."
Yeah.
And saying like, "No, I'm doing this as part of my job." It's like, your job is not to anonymously go on there. If you, this is obviously your own spare time. So if you actually are doing this in the name of a person in Congress because you are employed by them.
Please tell me their name.
Yes. Then by all means, sign in, make sure we know what that trail is, and then put your name associated with it. And then
surprisingly, they didn't do that, did they?
And they refused to do that. Most likely because the congressperson that they represented had no idea that they were doing it.
Yeah,
because it was obvious that was going to be something that is going to have blowback.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think it's quite a testament to the moderators on Wikipedia. The amount of that kind of stuff they have to manage is amazing. I mean, if you look at the language in most posts, they are the language is relatively neutral, factual. You know, it's pretty good about that. And anytime you see something that's not like that, you have to reread it a couple times. And most of the time, it's a quote. And you're like, oh, good. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm kind of always amazed at the work that goes into making Wikipedia a valuable
But once you have those, and it just reminded me with the Twitter account, once you have these automated tools, be able to say, hey, these IP addresses are causing a specific amount of problem in the things that are categorized as politics or, you know, in social issues, then it becomes a lot easier actually to narrow things down, to have a targeted search to say, okay, let's watch this more carefully. If we don't watch something else, likely it's not going to be as big of an issue.
Right. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Phoenix and Miles. Next time on the 7th Avenue Project, host Robert Pauly talks to Max Brooks, son of Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft, about his graphic novel, The Harlem Hellfighters. It's a true story of a black regiment in World War I who fought bravely abroad while facing racism at home. Also, Max talks about his own military career, his battles with dyslexia, and the perception of being a privileged celebrity kid, and the massive popularity of his zombie fiction. That's on the 7th Avenue Project here tomorrow on KUSP, or anytime you want, available via npr.org. You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell, and we have a few geek bits. Now, geek bits are something you got to see to believe. Miles, what's yours?
Mine is a video, and it's 25 years old.
Okay.
So, timely. This is actually
fresh.
Voyager, on its trip out of the solar system, made some stopovers at various planetary...
Can we say swing-bys instead of stopovers?
Swing-bys.
Okay, sure.
Well, gravitational assists, yeah, okay, they're swing-bys. Yeah, you're right. Okay.
Rotations, maybe. Yeah.
Yes. And they stop by Triton, one of the moons in our solar system. And they stitch together a bunch of images that they were making. And, you know, with Voyager, you're millions of kilometers in between frames.
Sure.
But for some reason, this seems like a steady stream because we're talking about such
space
vast distances.
Sure.
And so they're now releasing this, and we're going to put the link up on the website after
the show. Geekspeak.org, sure.
And you'll get to see a flyby and a view over of the moon Triton.
Awesome. From 25 years ago. Stitched together to be contemporary to some degree. Thank you so much. And Phoenix, before we get into Burning Man discussions, you got one as well. The Average Explorer, you're talking about that research project.
Yes, there's a YouTube video of it in action, which helps explain a lot of what I've found with especially digital art type stuff. For the even if it's research like this is, it's really hard to explain.
Yeah,
what
yeah,
this
seeing
is.
It,
once you see it, it makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, I'd seen it beforehand, a little stills of it at least, and went,
yeah,
I can explain this. And as we got into it, I'm like, you better go see this, everybody. So if you'd like to see the stuff we talk about, and in fact, all the news stories we cover on GeekSpeak, all the stories we cover, we add a little bit more content right after the show ends. We kind of conglomerate a page together. That's geekspeak.org. Okay, Burning Man is this big festival, if you will, that happens in the desert. And it's happening starting Monday. Actually, in fact, the build has already started. A lot of people have already gone and camped. I've never gone. You've gone many times.
Nine times.
You have stuff covered in playa dust, I'm assuming.
I have lots of stuff covered in playa dust.
Yeah.
So it comes out randomly once in a while and be like, oh, okay, that went to Burning Man and didn't get washed.
Yeah. So I had a fun project this last week. I was like, you know, Burning Man's happening on Monday. I want to get someone that's a burner on the show on Saturday live. That's a really hard thing to do. So thank you for being here. I'm sorry you're not Burning Man this year. So tell us, like... All I know about it really is that it's got amazing builds, tons of people. It's hot. It's dusty. It's kind of its own political environment where it kind of the rules are different than normal society to some degrees. There's a lot of drugs, a lot of nudity. There's a lot of difference. And that's all. That's my general assumption. Tell me more.
I would try to de-emphasize the drugs and nudity because yes, it happens there, but it's really not what Burning Man is ultimately about. There is, I'd say there's probably more nudity than there is drugs, but that's beside the point. And also as far as people being there have been people there for over a month now. They start setting up about a month early.
Wow.
So it's a week-long festival in the Black Rock City Desert, or Black Rock Desert, in, the northern Nevada, about, 80 or 90 miles northeast of Reno, what should I start with, like some history of it? There's so much to talk about.
One of the things that's kind of amazing about it is the amount of people that go. So it's kind of a city that gets created in a month, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's there. I believe 65,000 people this year.
Yeah, that's a lot of people.
Which is larger than the majority of cities in the U.S.
The majority of it gets built up in a week. It's up for another week maybe, and then it gets torn back down and most of it gets burned. Or at least the art projects quite frequently get burned.
The
man, it's the center of the center of the whole thing is a giant man that they put at the center of this big circle. Everyone camps around it. And that man gets burned on the following Saturday from the Monday that it starts. So it's
a week from today.
It always ends on Labor Day weekend, so mm-hmm. the Monday to Monday. They also build a temple as a regular part of the event that's happened since year 2000. And that temple is a more of a contemplative space where the man is sort of more of a party space, if you will.
Okay.
Usually quite impressive. Like a few years ago, the last time I went, they built a giant flying saucer.
As the temple.
Walk around. No, as the man.
Oh, as the man. Okay.
As the man. So you could walk around inside of this flying saucer and then walk up right underneath the man. The temples themselves are these beautiful, hard to describe buildings made from old pieces of... They originally started off as the tailing pieces of wooden models of dinosaurs. So you have these wooden models where you have they would mill the model the pieces out of them, but then they have the frame left over or the other pieces, and they would build these huge. The largest one they ever did was a quarter mile wide. It's a quarter mile long.
Yeah, quarter mile long. Okay,
so very, very large.
Yeah. And those structures, the temples and the Burning Man, are made with flammable material, and they do get burned at the end.
They do get burned at the end. Not everything gets burned.
Right.
But
in fact, one of the reasons why I was trying to get the author of Burning Man Art on Fire, it's a big picture book, which I actually have here, and it's by Jennifer Razor and photography by Scott London and Sydney Ithrell. And if you're interested in this topic and seeing what it looks like, I definitely highly recommend this book. It's beautiful imagery. And the stuff that's created, what was interesting is as I was flipping through this book and looking at the photographs of it, I recognize some of these sculptures because they were put in Burning Man, they were made for Burning Man, but then they get moved and installed places. So on Treasure Island, for example, there's a large steel woman's kind of transparent torso, or actually full body, I think.
Correct.
And it's probably 30 or 40 feet tall. And that was once at Burning Man and then installed in Treasure Island.
And you'll see it in major fairs as well.
You're right. A lot of these
things. There's a lot of overlap there.
Well.
Yeah. So one of those installations, and I believe it's the one at Treasure Island, although I could be mistaken which one it was, at Burning Man, of course, it's actually bigger and more impressive. The one that I think it's the one you're talking about was originally of a woman holding out her hand to a child, and that child was 20 feet tall too. You know,
and proportionally.
Tall,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Proportionally. And she has... red fire coming out of her hand, dripping down onto the child, and then her footprints go out behind her. There's all these giant footprints, and those are all on fire.
Fire for long periods of time.
Long periods of time.
They have fuel. It's a sculptural piece.
And they're all different colors of fire.
So this is the kind of stuff you see at Burning Man, right? Like a 40-foot sculpture with fire qualities that you can walk around and engage with, right? Kind of amazing.
Burning Man is the biggest and one of the best art galleries in the world. I've seen art there that I've never seen. Nothing else compares to it. Nothing else. You can't even really do it anywhere else because there's, you know, where are you going to be able to take a, you know, well, there's even bigger ones that I've seen, you know, 100-foot sculpture, set it on fire and be allowed to do that.
And you could do that places, but you wouldn't have any people there. Right, no one would see it. So that's
right.
The other thing is that there's 65,000 people as audience and participants to see this kind of thing.
Right, and not everything's about fire either. You know, there are these very large sculptures. There are very interactive sculptures. Mm-hmm. That's a very big prominent feature of Burning Man is participation.
Right.
They have one of their principles. They have a set of 10 principles. I always forget all of them, but there's a few of them here that I remember. One is everyone's a participant, and that what that really means is that art is meant to be interacted with. This is very different than, say, a standard gallery or a museum or something like that, where art is meant to be seen.
Yeah,
it's a form of living art.
Well, I would say traditional art museums. I think a lot of museums are getting into the idea that,
especially because some of the art is the mode of transportation that people got to get there.
That is correct as well. There are a ton of they call them mutant vehicles. So, in fact, they have a DMV. It's called the Department of Mutant Vehicles. You have to register your vehicle.
Is that true with all vehicles? You've got to register them.
Only the ones that are allowed to drive around. Once you get there, if you're in a regular car, you won't be allowed to move the car at all unless you have to get permission or do it sneakily. Mm-hmm. But you're not allowed to drive around the playa.
Because the area, just your sense of distance is very skewed.
It's very
just not
skewed.
Safe.
Yeah, so it is a very large, very flat desert. Very large area. I believe the circle has a radius of something like 2 miles of the space.
So it's 65,000 people in 2 miles with crazy vehicles powered by unknown means, sometimes giant art sculptures, sometimes dangerous, and lots of dust. We're going to get right back to this. We're talking about Burning Man. We have Phoenix and Miles in the audience, in the house with us. I'm Lyle Troxel. We'll be right back. So there's this amazing desert in northern Nevada. 65,000 people come. It takes a month to set up. They're there for a week. They burn a whole bunch of stuff. There's tons of stuff. I've assumed the site gets really dirty over time.
You know, actually, one of the principles is leave no trace. And they're really adamant about it. And when you come into Burning Man, if you leave junk sitting around, you will immediately have somebody saying, pick that up, do something with it, put it away. It's a
it's like a strict version of Singapore.
You're you know, you're supposed to take out what you bring in.
Okay.
And admittedly, you know, there are people who don't, you know, but they rate, you know, everyone, when you come in, you camp in an area, they go around and they figure out where you're camped, and they rate all the areas for cleanliness afterwards. And if you,
so there's some responsibility and people check,
right? And yeah. And so they have theme camps. These mm-hmm. they're called theme camps. These are kind of the officially recognized camps from the that are providing some sort of service.
And it's normally a collaborative group that decides to do a certain thing.
Yeah. Performances, music,
food,
art projects, all kinds of stuff. If you leave a mess, you won't be invited back. If you leave it clean, you'll get a better spot next year. And so it's very much a reward system around how clean you leave a space. They also clean up. They also spend a month cleaning up afterwards.
So I'm assuming all the stuff the garbage they've burned and the garbage refuse from that, the ash and stuff of that nature, gets trucked out.
It gets trucked out. If you want to burn, you have to make a burn platform. So it's a special. It's just not scorch the playa.
The playa. Okay.
So you're not allowed to leave damage to the playa at all.
Wow.
And you know, the year after year after year, BLM comes back and looks at it because they check it, and year after year they say Burning Man leaves less trash than a family camping at the playa would leave.
No way! So, that's incredible.
So BLM, Bureau of Land Management.
Bureau of Land Management.
Who actually owns that manages that desert.
That manages that desert. And Bureau of Land Management and Burning Man, they sometimes have little, you know, arguments, but they're very much... They work together very well.
Right. And I'm assuming Burning Man is a corporation. Is it a for-profit corporation or non-profit?
It is now a non-profit organization. Okay. It was for-profit for a while, but now it's run by a non-profit organization.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
I don't know that much of the ins and
outs. Yeah, okay. So clearly it's an amazing experience. Is it not right for everybody, or would you say anybody should experience this? What's your take on that?
I think with one exception, everyone that I've ever known that has gone, no matter what their objections to it, has come back saying it was one of the most amazing things they've ever done. And there's only one exception to that that I've ever known. So I suspect
Burning
there's
Man.
The rare person who mm-hmm. it's not right for. Maybe if you've got medical conditions or...
Oh, yeah, I'm sure there's some situations where you don't want
really
to be in the desert for a week.
Some sort of extreme attitude of... you know, it's a very inclusive environment.
Right.
If you have a deep-seated... issue with nudity, then
well, even that goes away really quickly. I mean, you know, there.
For most.
I'll give a very quick story. One year I was there. We were wandering around with some friends, and we ran across this guy who was handing out. We were standing in front of a burn barrel, and he was handing out these little piles of powder. And at first, we thought he was handing out drugs, but they're not. It wasn't. He said, "It's not drugs. Don't eat it." You know. And he says, "When I tell you, I hand it up to everybody. And when I tell you, throw this into the fire." And when we did, the fire lit up in all the colors of the rainbow.
Oh,
so he's
cool.
Handing out little piles of powdered metals and things like that. So we ended up hanging out with him for the rest of the night and never saw him again after that. But talking with him, he's like, he was a demolitions expert. He likes to blow stuff up, which is why he likes Burning Man. And he said, if we were to talk outside of Burning Man, if we were to talk politics, we probably wouldn't agree with each other. He said, I'm very much different than most of the people here, but I won't talk politics here.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm here to have fun and to be with people who like the things that we all like here.
Exploration, art,
you know. And yeah. He was a big bear of a guy, you know. And later that night, we found a kid that had taken too much acid, and I really want to emphasize there is drugs there, but there's not as much as people make the stories out to be.
Sure.
I don't do drugs there, for instance. Mm-hmm. I never do. This kid was having a bad trip, and this guy, I would say, the guy was very straight edge, doesn't do anything right. Like that himself. And he saw the guy, came up and gave him a big bear hug and said, I will sit with you till you're okay.
Oh,
I'm going
nice.
To stay with you.
Yeah.
And so this is somebody who, outside the world, I might not even have ever talked to.
Right.
Probably would never talk to.
So we're talking about Burning Man. This is Phoenix Taves is with us, and we're chatting about the Burning Man. The festival's been going on since 1986 or so.
1986.
When did you first go?
1990.
So what's it like? What's it like in the 90s compared to the last time you went? Did you go last year?
Yeah, I went last year.
So how did it change from the cycle that you've been to? Yeah.
I would say every single year is different. And it really depends on so many factors. So I can't, it's hard to, in terms of the large structural things, I can say there's a lot more people.
Mm-hmm.
When I first went, there were 15,000 people. Now there's 65,000.
That's a difference.
Big difference. But they've done a really good job of managing the way the space is constructed in such a way that it doesn't feel like you're overwhelmed by the people. You can get away from the, get them far enough away if you're somebody that's a little bit introverted, or you can go interact in a project or be, you know, be, you know, part of something that interests you, without necessarily feeling overwhelmed like you're crowded in. But that is one of the big differences there. One of the other big differences is way back in, I went in 1992 and I got to go a couple days early. Because I was setting up a theme camp, and I got to see the whole city built. And usually you didn't see the city wouldn't be fully built till Wednesday or Thursday of the week of,
yeah,
of the burn, of
right,
Burning
right.
Man.
It used to be only a week out they'd build it. Sure.
Yeah, they'd be so you Wednesday or Thursday everything would be built up, and then by Friday or Saturday it would be all disappearing again. So you get this really sense of this thing growing and then disappearing.
Right. There's never a point where it's lull.
Where it's a lull. Right. Yeah. Whereas now it's so big that it's really hard for them to let that happen. So most of the buildup happens the week before people arrive.
Yeah.
So if you're part of a project, you can go early.
So what is it like to go early? Is it everybody's building stuff?
And everybody's building
construction
stuff.
Everywhere?
Construction everywhere. People are, at least this was back in 2002 when I went and did that. There was sort of this little bit more of a camaraderie of everyone there was there early, was there to do something.
Yeah, sure.
You know, so there was a little bit less of the spectatorship.
Right.
And there's a little bit more spectatorship that happens now than it used to. It used
yeah,
to be
sure.
Far
well, with 65,000 people, I mean, it didn't get that much larger in the sense of the build out. I mean,
yeah.
It's huge, of course, but there's a lot more people that are just there to experience.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, that's totally fine as well, I'm assuming.
It's still an amazing experience.
Right.
It's just a different experience.
So we're talking about Burning Man. It's happening starting on Monday. Actually, the build's been happening already. And we're speaking with Phoenix Taves all about his experiences there, but mostly about a little bit about Burning Man so people have a better idea of what it actually is.
I got one question. What's the geekiest thing you ever saw at Burning Man?
Oh, man.
What's a geeky thing that of note?
How about an 80-foot tower that's lighting up based off of the music around it?
Oh yeah, there's tons of that.
Yeah.
Here's a geeky one. Here's a really geeky one for you. And I think this happened back around 2002, 2003, somewhere around there. Somebody had set up a camp that was lit up at night with neon to look like Battlezone, the old game Battlezone.
Okay.
So Battlezone's an old vector style game.
Sure. So the neon tubes were the vectors.
The neon tubes were the vectors, and they had vehicles made to look like the tanks and the UFOs and the other elements that move around, and they would drive around the playa in these things, and they looked just like it was Battlezone.
It looked like you were in a live Battlezone.
Yeah, it was all like that 2D, 3D sort of back and forth feeling, because it's all wireframed.
Oh, cool.
And they also even had in Battlezone, there's this little ping sound that you hear periodically. That ping sound was coming out from the, and it was, they made it loud enough you could hear it from all over the place.
This is the all green vectors. Was all of it green?
It was all green.
Oh, that's really cool. This is I don't know. Do you remember that tank game?
Yep.
Yeah. Pretty awesome.
So that
I was actually wondering, when things get blown up, did anyone ever do any?
Because when it blows up, like the vectors kind of get moved out of the way. Probably would be multiple.
Tons of this, yes. There's lots and lots of things like fire sculptures that are that have what do you call them? Rockets on the back of them so that they spin around really fast.
Okay.
Spin around in all these different ways. You know, they have lots of things like that. There's one that I saw that was a tree, an iron tree, with flowers that were on fire.
Oh, cool.
Just really, really beautiful. You could sit underneath the tree. It was, you know, if it's not going to immediately kill somebody,
they'll allow it. Well, so that's a little bit about Burning Man. Of course, if you're listening to this, you probably aren't going, because it's time to start traveling down to do that. But in any case, it's one of those things. It's actually hard to get into at this point, right? You've got to win a lottery.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
So if you're interested, stay focused on it throughout the year. When the tickets open up, you want to submit, and it's a bit of work to get there.
And clean up after you're done.
Thank you, Phoenix, for talking about Burning Man a bit. I want to just cover one little thing. Miles, one more rule about Google's self-driving car. California made another rule about it.
Actually, they didn't make a new rule. They were saying that Google's autonomous car needs a steering wheel and pedals. And the reason for that is because that is legislated as necessary for a car. And so it's more of like, okay, we have these rules that didn't have a self-driving car in mind. And now there's a self-driving car. Okay, let's do this while we work out the details of...
Because I got to say that having a steering wheel in one of these vehicles would be more dangerous. Like that's kind of
absolutely.
Because you don't want the human being who's not as fast as the software.
Horrible at this.
Just don't hook the steering wheel up to anything so they can pretend like
there you go. It's perfect, right? The steering wheel can be a hint. You know, it's just one of the inputs. I'd like to turn right. No, you don't. Awesome.
So it's like Maggie on The Simpsons.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
All right, very cool. Today on GeekSpeak was Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie and a regular to the show. And Phoenix Taves, a Burning Man and enthusiast of some degree and a software developer. And Phoenix, it's a pleasure to have you on the show for the first time. I hope to have you back on again. I'm Lyle Troxell. You're listening to KUSP Public Radio. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. Hey, and GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3 share and share alike. So you can use our content any way you like. Just tell them the Geeks sent you. To find out more about this program or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit us at geekspeak.org, where we put up show notes and all that stuff. This is GeekSpeak for August 23rd, 2014. We'll be back next week here on KUSP. Thanks for listening.